There's this great painting of Jesus washing Peter's feet. In it, the disciples sit around a table watching and looking very nervous. One is rubbing his fingers together like a child waiting for something frightening to happen. Another has his hands clasped together in prayer. A third is wide-eyed, resting his chin on his hands, just baffled. One is even holding his head in his hands like this. He can't believe what's happening. Then there's Peter, having his feet washed. You know it's Peter because he's got the long beard, which is like an artist's cue for the rest of us. Poor guy must have looked like Santa since grade school. Anyway, like the rest of them, Peter is upset by this foot washing. He looks disappointed and uncomfortable. He's not happy. Lord, are you going to wash my feet? You'll get it later, Peter. No, no. You will never wash my feet. You can imagine everyone in the room nodding in agreement as Peter refuses, because refusing was the only right thing to do. See, life was a pretty dusty affair in Jesus' day, especially in a dry place like Palestine. Dirt paths and dirt city squares and open-toed sandals meant that your feet got pretty nasty. So when you went inside, it wasn't enough to take your shoes off. You needed to wash your feet. Custom had it that a bowl of water would often be ready for guests to wash. It was a nice thing to do for someone, and it also happened to benefit yourself and your floors. Sort of a win-win, like offering someone a Tic Tac. But here's the important part. You washed your own feet. In certain rare situations, a slave might wash your feet, and rarer still, a student might wash a teacher's feet as an act of devotion. But you pretty much just did it yourself. And you certainly never expected your superior to wash your feet. Now, as with most customs, this was ingrained into you from childhood, which is why that painting, it captures the scene so well. As the disciples squirm and Peter scowls, Jesus was doing the unthinkable, which made them uncomfortable. So they protest and fidget and pray. And Jesus? Well, Jesus just keeps washing. In the painting, you know it's Jesus because he's got a halo, another one of those not-so-subtle artist cues. And as he's washing Peter's feet, you see, this isn't just a symbolic action. Pour a little water to let them know that he would stoop to the level of a slave for them. No, Jesus is scrubbing and getting between the toes. He's kneeling down. He's stooping. This isn't an act to show he loves them. This is love. This is Jesus loving. Which I guess is sort of the answer to the big question, why? Why does Jesus do this? You might think he just likes breaking social norms, likes doing things on the Sabbath and challenging authority and hanging out with all the wrong people. And that might be true, but I don't think Jesus is a rebel without a cause. He's not just washing feet to subvert social norms. He's doing it out of love. That's what it says at the beginning of the story. Jesus, knowing his time had come to leave the world, loved his disciples to the end. He loved to the end. We're taking a turn in the story this week. All of Jesus' miracles and most of his teaching and the like, that all happens in the first half of John. The last half, this part, focuses on his final days. And Jesus knows it. Jesus knows this is the beginning of the end. He knows this is the time when charges will be manufactured and trials rushed and justice ignored. He knows this will be the time of betrayal and denial and death. And through it all, Jesus loved them. He loved them to the end. And to the end does not just mean that Jesus loved them up to his final days. The end, or teleos, if you're into the whole Greek thing, the end also means the ultimate purpose or goal or end game. Like in the phrase, the ends justify the means. Jesus loved them to the end. He loved them not as a means of achieving something else, not as a step toward a greater goal. Love was the greater goal. Love was the end game. Love was the reason for it all. Love was the end. Because? Well, because that's just who Jesus is. That's who God is. One for whom love is the real reason for it all. Love is the end. So of course he's willing to break rank, to breach social norms. Those things just don't matter so much to Jesus. Love is the end. So he grabs the towel and he grabs the bowl and he loves them. With water he loves them. He loves Peter, who will deny him. He even loves Judas, who will betray him. Love is the end. and nothing will get in the way of that. As their feet dry, Jesus puts his outer robe back on. Then he joins them at the table. After a moment of, I imagine, awkward silence, he tells them that what he's just done should be an example for them. They must wash each other's feet. Which, of course, is probably not a literal command. That would be anticlimactic, right? Discipleship is about more than clean feet. No, I think he's asking them, he's telling them, to love to the end, to make love their end also. That's terrifying, because this sort of love is costly. Look what it cost Jesus. Loving to the end is what brought him back to see Lazarus and put him in harm's way. Loving to the end is what has him washing Judas' feet instead of stopping him. Loving to the end cost Jesus his life. And we'd be foolish to think the same isn't true for us. Loving to the end will cost us. It will cost us our time and our treasure and in some way or another our lives. As Pastor Dan reminded us last week, quoting Bonhoeffer, when Jesus bids us, he bids us to come and die. So yeah, loving to the end is terrifying. But I think it's also freeing. Because no one else is telling us this. No one else is telling us that love should be the end. No one else is even telling us that love can be the end. In fact, it seems this world is always telling us why it cannot be. Like the disciples in this story, like the disciples in that painting, we are bound by social customs. We are bound by profit motives. We are bound by the expectations of neighbors and the sensible guidance to always care for yourself first. And that's not to mention our own commitment to fairness, or how we want to make people deserve what they're given, or our own sense of who we're supposed to help and who we aren't, who we're to love and who we're supposed to hate. That's not to mention our greed, our lust, our fear. Now, I know some of those rules and norms are meant to help us love better, to help us as a society care for one another more completely. Building codes and food laws and etiquette and the rest. These are good things. Jesus isn't advocating for anarchy. But I think he'd grow tired. He'd grow tired of the way our rules and norms limit love. He'd grow tired of the way our inner squirming prevents us from letting love be the end. And I think we all grow tired of it too. I know I do. It's like love is bound, sequestered behind a bunch of red tape. About 4 years ago, Kristen came home from school and told me about a student of hers who was homeless. A father and three elementary-aged kids with no money were living in their Honda Civic. It broke her heart. So we called IHN, but they were full. Kristen thought we should consider letting them stay in our basement. I said we should maybe meet them first and then think about it, you know? There was a lot to consider. The next day, Kristen called over lunch to let me know she'd arranged a meeting with the family for dinner that night. On our way to Chipotle, Kristen said, I want them to come over after dinner. They can't stay in a car another night. My mind filled with all the alarm bells, all the red tape, all the buts. But we don't have a bed. But we don't have anything about, but we don't know anything about them. What if he's a former felon or in the U.S. illegally? There are rumors, you know. But what will the rules be? But how long can they stay? But the basement isn't clean. But I wanted to watch TV tonight. But I'm scared. I looked at Kristen, ready to deliver this onslaught of buts, and I realized something every married person should know. Sometimes your spouse isn't making a request. They're just letting you know something they've already decided. We weren't going to Chipotle to meet these three kids and their dad. We were going to Chipotle to bring them home. It was settled. For the next few weeks, we had a family living in our basement. Friends and family pitched in with an air mattress and meals and money to help fix up the Civic. We grew to love those kids and their father. We also grew to become frustrated with them at times. Loving like this is costly. And though we see them much less, sometimes we still are frustrated. But the weirdest feeling of those few weeks was the feeling of freedom. It felt like we were finally free to let love be the end, you know? It's like we can always come up with reasons to not love. We can always point to the cost and to efficiency and to worrying about what the neighbors will say and to HOA rules and to just plain old fear. We can always say that's just not how it's done. Teachers don't wash their disciples' feet. But for 3 weeks, back in the fall of 2013, we let love be the end. And it felt great. And I hear stories like this from all of you all the time. Maybe not all the time, but definitely enough to know that my feeling of freedom wasn't unusual. This calling from Jesus, this calling to put love as the top priority, to let all things serve love and to put aside those things which hinder it, this calling is terrifying and costly. And just the thought of it might make you run to all those buts, might make you think Jesus is being a bit too naive. But the calling is also freeing. To strip the robe of customs and rules and all those buts, to take up the towel and bowl and just wash feet, making love the end, it's freeing. As it did for Jesus, it costs life, but rest assured that as it did for Jesus, it also gives life like nothing else can. May God grant us the courage, the wisdom, and the faith to join Jesus in finding the freedom of loving to the end. Amen.